Thanks for downloading and listening to Season 3 of the Nine Narrow Chronicles. This is Season 67, 68, the season after the season that was, and it's quite an eventful season, so you will see. Playing in the background is The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck, and you can tweet in and tell me his real name. That was number one on the opening day of the season, of the league season, in September of 1967, and we will go out with Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World, which was number one on the 24th of reached number one on the 24th of April, so was number one when Celtic clinched the third title in a row. Also happening in that season, Winnie Ewing, in season 67-68, Winnie Ewing became an MP, an SNP MP, so that was quite an amazing event for the UK at the time, and for Scotland in particular. Charles de Gaulle vetoed Britain's entry into the European Union. There was also the launch of the QE2, which I mentioned on the podcast. And if you wanted to watch television on the night that Celtic opened the league campaign, the TV was England 11 versus the rest of the world 11 at cricket, grandstand, jukebox jury, Patrick Troughton was Doctor Who, part 2 of the Tomb of the Cybermen was on, the Dick Van Dyke show was on, the Munsters was on, High Adventure, The Adventures of Casanova, Billy Cotton's Music Hall, The News, The Defenders, then Match of the Day, and then Out of Town Theatre, The Picnic. That was your TV choice September 1967. And if you were watching BBC, instead of going to see Celtic clinch the title, on the last day of the season, you would have seen Jack and Ori, Deputy Dog, The Mountains of Glass, The Magic Roundabout, The News, Tom and Jerry, Wicker's World, Conflict in Kentucky, Z Cars, British The Happy Family, Moira Anderson Sings, Sports View, 24 Hours, and then Omnibus. So that would have been your TV viewing. And the big films launched at the beginning of 1968, because we did 67's films in season 66-67. The big films in the beginning, the first half of season of 1968, so season 67-68, were 2001 A Space Odyssey and Planet of the Apes. Anyway, that was me with a lead in to this. We've got an extra guest this week. We've got Lackey Moore. So we've got Lackey, St. Anthony, and Robert talking about season 67-68, the Battle of Montevideo, giving you some. If you've looked online on Twitter, you'll see that I tell you to go online and watch some of the games. So anyway, enough of me. This is Engelbert Humperdinck in the background. You've got Louis Armstrong, What a Wonderful World, at the end. And this is me, Harry Brady, passing over to the gents, saying good night and God bless. I have the last waltz with you. After the fantastic results of the 66-67 season, we entered the 67-68 season with what must have been hope for more success to follow, but it was quite an unusual season in that regard. We've got an extra guest on this week. We are joined by Lackey Moore. How are you doing, Lackey?
I'm fine, thanks.
And we've got St. Anthony and we've got Robert. So, Lackey, I've just said we finished season 66-67 beating Real Madrid in the testimonial in Madrid. Mm-hmm. We must have entered season 67-68 with tremendous expectations that we were going to go on and win even more trophies. What was your memory of expectations going into that season?
I remember that there was some sort of a rule change or some sort of legal hitch. I can't remember the exact details for it that made Celtic play in the first round of the European Cup. Normally the holders up till then, they'd never played in the first round. But for some reason, Celtic had to play Dynamo Kiev. And the first game at Celtic Park, I think they were taken by surprise and lost 2-1.
Well, we'll get on to that in a minute, but what were your expectations going into the season?
I just thought they would go on the way they'd done before. I mean, there was no reason to suspect that. I think you didn't expect to win everything again, but there was no reason to suspect that there would be so many dramatic events that affected them during the season. Because it was, in some ways, it was a more dramatic season than the Lisbon season, but for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and we'll get on to all the reasons. So we started the League Cup. One of the comments you'd made before, Robert, about the League Cup sections, we were in a section with Celtic, Dundee United, Rangers and Aberdeen. Quite a section of the League Cup. And we started off, that's what kicked off the season on the 12th of August. And we started off beating Dundee United. So the League Cup was continuing to be a cup that we were going to be successful in, Robert. But that's quite a group section to start with.
It was a very tough section for us because Dundee United had given us so much problems the previous season. And even in the two league games in the Lisbon season, we hadn't beaten Aberdeen either. Both games were draws. So between those two and Rangers, it was a very, very tough section. Rangers had strengthened during the summer. We talked in the last podcast about them losing or discarding Jim Forrest and George McLean, two of their principal goal scorers. So in the summer, they had gone out and spent quite a lot of money on Alex Ferguson, who'd had quite a good track record against us as a player for Dunfermline. They also signed Andy Penman from Dundee, who was an experienced attacking midfield player. And they'd signed Orjan Persson, who was the Swedish international left wing, and who was immediately christened Orange Persson by the Ibrox faithful. So it was a tough group. You know, everybody wanted to beat the champions of Europe. And it was great when you got drawn against Rangers in the sections because it was a chance, because only one team qualified, it was a chance to put them out of one tournament before August was even completed. I remember being at the Dundee United match, the first game, and I think we Jimmy scored in the last couple of minutes, a narrow win, but you know any win against Dundee United was to be enjoyed. And then, you know, the two games that were going to decide the section were obviously considered to be the Old Firm games. Both of them were played on Wednesday nights in August, and both matches were a tale of penalty kicks, and Celtic could easily have lost both of them. The first one was at Ibrox. Interestingly, it wasn't an all-ticket game, and, you know, the crowd was 95,000 for Wednesday night, Old Firm game at Ibrox, incredible crowd. We led with a Tommy Gemmell penalty. In the second half, they got a penalty, which Andy Penman took, brilliantly saved by Ronnie Simpson. There was a great picture, which I remember the next day in the Scottish Daily Express, which was a big broadsheet newspaper in those days of Simpson saved. Anyway, that game finished 1-1. And then 2 weeks later, this was really the one to decide the group. We played Rangers at Parkhead. They led quite early on through a Willie Henderson goal. And with 15 minutes to go, Rangers got a penalty. And Kai Johansson nearly broke the crossbar with the spot kick. We were off the hook. And we scored three in the last 12 minutes. One, which was a rasping shot from Bobby Murdoch. So, you know, we got through the section, and to all intents and purposes, that was a very good start to the season and no signs of the troubles to come in the first half of the season.
I think if I can come in there, I think the point about the Kaya Hansen penalty that was dramatic was that when it came back off the crossbar, he headed it. And Ferguson was running in with a view to scoring, and Kaya Hansen headed it. He claimed it was over the line, and Celtic got a free kick, and he went straight up the park to the free kick and got a corner, and then scored. So instead of being 2-0, it became 1-1.
So Kai Johansson took the penalty, hit the rebound, and then he headed it.
It came down on the line and came out again, and he headed it.
Aye, so it's a free kick.
It was a free kick for Celtic.
Yeah.
And Ferguson was raging because he thinks he would have scored. I think it's a good story about the first game when they drew 1-1. And I was working in the buses at the time in Langside Garage, and they had this shop steward, an old guy, Duncan McLeod his name was, and he came in the next day and he said to me, "Have you been to Govan yet, George?" And I said, "No." He said, "Do you know the newspaper man who stands outside the bus to the subway station?" I said, "Yes." He says, "He's out there, he's shouting, 'Sensation, sensation, European Cup champions held by local team.'"
There's one other wee thing I'd like to mention there, Harry. I keep talking about my dad's reminiscences through the years, and he told me that night that we beat Rangers 3-1, that it was the last episode of The Fugitive in TV. Now, bear in mind, there wasn't any video in the days and catch up and all the rest of the stuff that we enjoy these days. And he says he was absolutely raging, that obviously he was going to go to the game. That wasn't a, you know, that wasn't a decision. But he said that after watching this TV programme avidly for the full summer, then it came to the last episode, and he always equated that game with the last episode of The Fugitive. And I remember saying to him, did you sort of regret maybe no seeing the TV programme? And he went, "No, son." He said, "You know, that was one of the best games ever in the Jock Stein era." He said, "With 15 minutes to go, we were dead in our feet. And they get the penalty, and everybody just thought that's the end. And within about the next 15 minutes, we'd absolutely ripped them apart."
To be fair, Celtic battered them that night. The goal that they scored and the penalty were breakaways, and Celtic dominated the game. My father was a senior referee and linesman, and when I grew up, I didn't know he was a Celtic supporter because he was very neutral. But when he stopped refereeing, he became a fanatic. He went to all the games. And that night, he was so upset at Tiny Wharton's performance, he was ready to leave when the penalty was given. I said, "Well, they've got to put up with it, so you may as well stand as well." So he was really quite happy afterwards that we won, as we all were.
The remarkable thing about that period in terms of the League Cup not being our greatest proportionate, our greatest trophy that we win, but the remarkable thing about that period is we lost in the League Cup final of 64-65, and we hadn't been in the League Cup for about 8-9 years before that. But 64-65 we lost, and then, so that was us in 64-65, 65-66, 66-67, this 67-68 season, next season 68-69, 69-70, then 70-71, 71-72 we lost, 70-71 we lost, 72-73 we lost, 73-74 we lost. We were in every final of the League Cup bar one through from 1964-5 season right the way through to 1977-78 season. That's a remarkable run of getting to cup finals, pretty much winning half and losing half.
You said there, Harry, that bar one, we were in them all. It was 14 consecutive. There wasn't a break.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we were in them all. It's remarkable that we were in that run, and as I say, roughly winning half, roughly losing half, when proportionately the League Cup isn't one of our better trophies, and then we go through a big chunk of period when we're not in it at all, or we're hardly in it at all. It's an amazing competition, but obviously with those results that we just read out there in the League Cup, and you know, if you look at our group of the League Cup, and then some of the other groups that season. It was quite an incredible group for us to get through, and then to go on and win the trophy. So the first trophy's in the bag. But in the meantime, as you touch on, Lackey, the champions of Europe went out in the first round against Dynamo Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
Did you manage to get to that game?
Yeah, I was in the Celtic end. Yeah, it was a
what went wrong?
Well,
should we have sacked the manager? That would be modern social media. Sack the manager.
They were really exposed by the pace of the Kiev forwards. I remember thinking it was one of the poorest games I'd seen John Clark play. That, you know, that at the end of the game, I was thinking I'd never seen him so exposed, which must have meant Billy McNeil didn't have a great game either, because they went through us like a knife through butter. They were very, very quick. And then, of course, in the second game in Moscow, Bobby Murdoch got ordered off and John Hughes had a goal disallowed. And apparently they were really good in Moscow. I heard the Moscow game and I'd gone to college by then. I had to listen to it on the radio. But I was at the first game and it was a shock. It really was.
What was the general reaction?
Always,
sorry, carry on, Robert.
I was going to say, I think it's always a bit unfortunate if you get drawn against, you know, a Soviet team or even, you know, any of the teams that are two-thirds or three-quarters into their league season, mm-hmm. in the first round of a European tournament. And, you know, they would have been so far up to speed, even though our first game against Kiev, I think, was in September. So we'd probably played, you know, at least a dozen competitive games. But, you know, it was as hard a draw as we could have expected. You know, I think Man United, who won the tournament that year, I think they might have got drawn against a team from Northern Ireland or something. So, you know, it was an unlucky draw for us. And, of course, they were a good team.
I think it's worthwhile pointing out here to younger listeners maybe who are used to the tournaments that we have these days with seeding involved in it, coefficients and all this nonsense that they've come up with, that we didn't have that in those days. It was an open draw. So it was very much a case of like the Scottish Cup, every name went into the hat and you could easily get pulled out with Real Madrid in the first round or you could have got a team for Luxembourg. It was, you just took your luck, the luck of the draw. So I think that's worthwhile pointing out.
So, I think the fact that Celtic had played Dynamo Kiev in previous seasons, and I think the Cup Winners' Cup, and prevailed, I think we felt quite confident we would beat them. But they were a good team on the night. They were very, very quick.
Yes, but I think the boot was on the other foot. You know, when we beat them in January, February 66, it was during their winter shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked on the podcast for the 65-66 season about Celtic's horrific journey that they took to get to Tbilisi because the game couldn't even be played in Kiev. So I think, you know, I think when you meet a team and they're either in season or out of season, you know, it can have a bearing, but you know, clearly Soviet football was at a pretty high level in the mid-60s and, you know, they were regular. Russians were well, or the Soviets were well used to qualifying for World Cups and European Championships. So, just unfortunate.
Yeah,
to go out
I mean,
so quickly.
To set some context as well in the time and tell me what you remember of any of this, George, on the same night, Rangers drew 1-1 away to Dynamo Dresden, which again you touched on it there, Robert, with the concept of playing behind the in the Soviet Union. They were in East Germany. For those under the age of 30, they will not remember that Germany used to be, for a period of time, Germany was two countries, East and West. Dynamo Dresden were an East German team. Hibs beat Porto 3-0 at home, both in the Fairs Cup, and I'm going to give my interesting fact about the Fairs Cup. So the Fairs Cup was a cup for cities. It was teams representing a city that morphed into the UEFA Cup. Clyde had finished third, in the old First Division, and Clyde should have been in the Fairs Cup. But because the Rutherglen Glasgow boundary goes through, two-thirds of it's in goes through Shawfield Stadium, two-thirds of Shawfield was in Glasgow and a third was in Rutherglen, UEFA decided that Glasgow already had teams in European competition, so Clyde never really recovered from the blow of not getting European football that season. Clyde didn't, should have been in Europe and weren't. The QE2 was launched from John Brown Shipyard in Clydebank that day. Do you remember anything about that, George?
I remember playing football against Knightswood Garage over in Knightswood, and you could see the QE2 from the pitch. You know, looking across the town, you could, it was, you, the ship was high enough above the buildings that you could actually see it. So I remember that. But, I don't remember any of these other teams. Because I really had no interest in them at all.
You got the day off school, Robert?
We got the day off school to either go to Clydebank, which was just about 5 miles away from me, or, you know, it was live on TV, the launch of the QE2. So, yeah, I remember that. Probably more excited about a day off school, though.
I did my thesis at college on Clyde Shipbuilding. And there wasn't much yet left by the time I'd finished the thesis.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, just to go back to my earlier point, Manchester United, who won the tournament, their first round tie was against a team from Malta.
Yeah.
Old Hibernians, actually. So, luck of the draw, wasn't with us. And, you know, we went out and, you know, maybe it became a factor in our favour in the second half of the season when we didn't have the distractions.
So,
you're the set of stuff, Brian. Can any of you remember why Celtic had to play that first round tie?
I think I've got the answer, and I'll need to look up to clarify it. There was an Albanian team due to take part in it, and what would happen at that point is it left Celtic as a buy-in to the next round. But because the Albanian team pulled out the competition, in order to have an equal amount of teams, it meant Celtic then went into the draw.
Right. But I knew there was something, there was an anomaly in previous seasons that the holders did not play in the first round.
Yeah, yeah.
The draw had been made before Dinamo Tirana pulled out. So the team that the Albanians were supposed to play was Eintracht Braunschweig, who were the West German champions, and they got a walkover and they got a bye into the second round. So there you go.
So if we then also, since this is a lack of interest in European football gone for the season, really interesting to note how the other Scottish teams performed in Europe that season. And they did pretty well in total. There was Aberdeen. They played four games. They were in two rounds. Dundee played eight games in the Intercity Fairs Cup. Hibs played six, and Rangers played six. And it was quite a remarkable set of games. Dundee. They got through against a Dutch team, Doa Welshkrat Kerk, or DWS as they were called, in the first round of the Intercity Fairs Cup. Rangers, as we talked about, they got past Dynamo Dresden 3-2. Leeds, who we will come to mention, although they're not a Scottish team, they become relevant in this, they beat CA Spora of Luxembourg 16-0 on aggregate. Hibs beat Porto 4-3 on aggregate, the 3-0 at Easter Road, and then lost 3-1 in Portugal. And then in the next round, Dundee beat a Belgian team 7-2. Rangers beat a West German team after beating an East German team. They beat Cologne 3-1. Hibs. So does anybody remember, or have any recollection, George or Robert, of the famous Hibs beat Napoli 4-1. They lost away in Italy, but they won 5-0 at Easter Road. Does anybody, either of you, have any recollections of that?
I remember picking up the newspaper the next morning and seeing that result with complete disbelief that any Scottish team could put five past an Italian team. So this was a good Hibs team, of course. Pat Stanton, Colin Steen was there, Pat Quinn, Peter Cormart. You know, so they're a terrific team. And on their day, they were a brilliant team.
I'm sure there's a fact there as well that Dino Zoff was the goalkeeper actually for Napoli before he went to Juventus. And I'm sure I read somewhere it was the only time in his career that he ever lost five goals.
Yeah. Any recollection of it, George?
Not really.
you only remember the Celtic.
When you go back over it, I remember these things. But at the time I was away, as you know, at college, it didn't really impact on me. I was only interested in what the Celtic were doing. In fact, I would probably have more memories of what was going on at Old Trafford Main Road because I used to go to the games. But I was only checking in on what was happening with the Celtic.
So the next round after that, with Dundee, Rangers and Hibs all through, excuse me,
were Aberdeen in the Cup Winners' Cup?
Aberdeen were in the Cup Winners' Cup, yep.
How did they do?
I'll get on to that in a minute. So, Hibs then played Leeds United in the next round and lost 2-1 in aggregate. The following round, and Dundee got through, the following round, Dundee beat FC Zurich in the quarterfinals of the Intercity Fairs Cup. Rangers drew 0-0 at Ibrox and lost 2-0 away to Leeds in the quarterfinals, so they were knocked out. So that's Leeds had put out Hibs, then Leeds put out Rangers, and then in the semi-finals it was 1-1 at Dens Park and then 1-0 at Ellen Road to Leeds for Leeds to beat Dundee. Otherwise Dundee were almost in the Fairs Cup final. Robert, do you have any recollection of that run with Leeds beating Rangers and then Leeds beating Dundee?
Yeah, I remember listening to the Leeds Dundee game on the radio. You know, our family were all from Fife and Dundee, so there was certainly a bit of support within our house for Dundee. And you know, I think it wasn't the first time they had gotten to a European semi-final, and they also had like Hibs, they had a great team at that time, and very unfortunate for them, and to lose so narrowly. And the guy who scored the deciding goal was Eddie Gray, the Scottish international. So the Leeds Rangers games, you know, is something that has quite a lot of significance for us in the second half of the season because of Rangers' fixture congestion. And we can talk about that a bit later when we talk about the league running.
I think one of the things that comes out of it, though, is how strong Scottish football was at the time. You know, when Celtic were dominating the leagues for those 9 years, they weren't playing against Hadies. They were playing against good teams who could compete in Europe to a certain level.
I think that was the case for a number of years.
Yeah.
Harry, do you want the Aberdeen scores in the Cup Winners' Cup?
Yeah, you give me the Aberdeen scores.
In the first round, they were up against Reykjavik and they won 10-0 at Pittodrie. And Frank Munro, who became a Celtic player, of course, in the mid-70s, he got a hat-trick in that game. In the away game, they beat Reykjavik 4-1, so that was 14-1 in aggregate. And then in the next round, they went out against Standard Liège of Belgium, 3-2 on aggregate.
I think it should be noted that Frank Munro was actually a terrific footballer. Many Celtic players' memories, or supporters' memories, was of that shambles at the end of his career. But he was actually a really, really good player.
I remember he scored an own goal on his debut for us.
Yeah.
I think against St Mirren, and Steen had made him captain as well on his debut.
He had been a terrific player.
Yes, I'm sure.
Good career.
So that's not the end of Celtic playing international football in the season 67-68, because there is one more competition that Celtic played in that goes down in our history is something that it's almost like a dirty secret. We don't really talk about it that much. So it was the World Club Championship, or the Intercontinental Cup, as it was called at the time, where Celtic played Racing Club of Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Two legs, initially, Hampden, in front of 83,437, and then away in South America in front of 120,000 people, and then a one-off game. So, who wants to start talking about that tie? George, did you manage to make it to Hampden? Well, first of all, why was the game at Hampden?
To a bigger crowd. It was bigger than Celtic Park, so they could accommodate more people. And they did the same with Leeds United. When they played Leeds United, they took it to Hampden. They often took games to Hampden in those days. They played Penarol. I think it was Penarol who were the reigning world champions in a friendly match and played brilliantly against them, 1-2-0. And I think they thought that was the kind of benchmark. But when they came up against Racing Club, they really were playing against a bunch of absolute hammer throwers. I remember when Argentina played England in the World Cup at Wembley, the day that Alf Ramsey refused to let them even shake hands and refer to them as animals. They really were a dirty team for all their brilliance, and they were brilliant. I mean, probably if Argentina had played proper football, they would have beaten England that day. And then like 2 years down the line, we play them in the World Championship, and you suddenly realise that for all their talent, they were really ruthless. In the first game at Celtic Park, they kicked everything above the grass. I mean, you'll see the footage of sort of serial kicks at Jimmy Johnson as he tries to run up the park. And it was a very, very bad feeling about the game, and there was a bad feeling about going over there. I mean, I came up from Manchester to go to the game when we won 1-0, and I remember thinking, it must have been more than 1-0, because it was an aggregate fixture. But it wasn't to be.
So, Robert, give us some insight into this game. You can talk about the whole thing. You can talk about the thing in the round, in the whole thing.
Well, I think the British football fans had only been introduced to Argentinian football, as Lackey says, the previous summer at the World Cup in England. And because no British team had won the European Cup before, nobody really had any experience of Argentinian club football. And the previous winners of the Intercontinental Cup, or the previous participants from the South American side, had been Peñarol on at least three occasions, Santos, Pelé's team from Brazil, who were obviously a great footballing side. But the 2 years that Inter Milan won the Intercontinental Cup had both been very hard-fought affairs against Independiente from Argentina. And, of course, Herrera himself was Argentinian by origin, and I'm sure Inter were better geared up to playing against an Argentinian club side than we were. And I think Jim Craig subsequently described Celtic as being a bit naive going into these games, and it was a new experience. There was a tremendous book written by Tom Campbell, one of the Celtic historians, called Tears in Argentina. And it's a very good book about the whole story of the three matches. There's a great quote from Jimmy Johnson. He says, "Well, it really was an experience. And when we got back to Scotland, we started to realise how good it was here compared to over there. Football seemed more civilised. Although the first match back here was at Airdrie." So I thought that was a good one from Wee Jimmy. But I think there was a lot of... You have to bear in mind also that if the away goals rule had been in place, we would have won the trophy after the second match. We lost 2-1. We were ahead in the second game. Tommy Gemmell scored with a penalty. Ronnie Simpson had been taken out of the game minutes before the kickoff. He was hit by a missile from the crowd behind the goal. John Fallon, at very short notice, had to step in. John Fallon, never one of Jock Stein's favourites. And I'm interested to hear from St Anthony, you know, who I know interviewed John Fallon, as to, you know, the discussion maybe about that game and then the game in Montevideo. I think Robert Kelly didn't want to play the third game. He'd seen enough after Hampden and Buenos Aires. I think Big Jock talked him into it. Big Jock, of course, was hugely proud of the way that we had won in Lisbon and the style of football that we had presented to the world. And I think it was a bit of a disaster for Jock, the way the game unfolded in Montevideo. It was an embarrassment. It was a great damage to our reputation as a football club, despite the provocation. And it certainly affected morale for a period afterwards. I think the game itself, there's enough footage. You know, Bobby Lennox gets sent off in a case of mistaken identity. Bertie Auld gets sent off but refuses to go off. Tommy Gemmell assaulted somebody but didn't get sent off. And, you know, Jimmy got sent off. John Hughes got sent off. So, you know, it was a dark hour, you know, in the club's history on such a high-profile occasion. And, you know, it's just a great pity that it happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. You should set the context for this about the away goals rule. So they had a strange system. You know, having a point system when you've only got two teams playing two games is very odd. It was 2 points for a win, one for a draw, no aggregate scores. So you could win 5-0 at home, lose 4-3 away, and the third tie would be required, which makes you think it was more of a money-making exercise than anything else when they were gearing it up so that a third game would be necessary in it. And again, you touch on there, Robert. I think I've heard before that Robert Kelly didn't want to play the third game, and it was the British ambassador who told them that we really needed to go and play it to avoid a diplomatic incident taking place. Because we played it just 3 days later, and again it was down in South America. So and as you rightly say, the amount of controversy, as Lackey points out, they kicked everything that moved in the first leg. We go over there and Ronnie Simpson has to not play because he's hit by a missile, and again they were thuggish in that game. It's no surprise that then we have, this is all boiling up and boiling up, we have four players sent off in the final tie.
Do you know what's remarkable when you watch those games? When you listen to the accounts of the players, our players, about what happened, they talk about the kicks off the ball and the hair pulling and the spitting and the punches in the kidney and stuff. And it was clear that they were masters of the dark arts. Celtic, weren't they? When you watch the Celtic players getting ordered off, it's because they hardly got a clue how to be sleeker. I mean, the John Hughes ordering off is comedy, but he just boots the goalkeeper. You know, although it was a tragic experience, if you watch it from a distance and compare the behaviour of the two teams, you'd think it was the Celtic or the thugs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's just so... I mean, actually, has anything ever changed? We get knocked out of Europe relatively recently by Juventus when they were doing all sorts of things. And it took us to go in at half-time and the manager to tell the players what to do before we knew how to deal with what they were doing in the penalty box.
Yeah, but in that game, if I recall, you could see them doing it and the referee was ignoring it. And that was one of the issues. I mean, they were putting their arms round Cooper, Hooper and things like that. But if you watch what you see of the remaining footage of those games, you don't see a lot of nasty stuff. You see some bad tackles. But the players complained about stuff going on off the ball all the time. You don't see any of that. The provocation caused the action is really seen.
Saint, you've done the interview with John Fallon. Why wasn't he one of Jock Steen's favourites?
He wasn't very good.
No, I think the thing with John is John's quite a forcible character. He's very opinionated, and I don't have a doubt that he wouldn't have been slow in telling Big Jock what he thought of him, and that might not have went down well. We were talking there, it's interesting to hear George talk about the footage that you can see. I know that Celtic were very, very unhappy about the BBC coverage that was shown throughout the UK, because it tended to show Celtic as the instigators, as the bad guys, when really what it was severe provocation, not only in the third game, but it built up over the course of the first two games as well. So I know for a fact that the club were really aggrieved at how the BBC, now it would have been the Scottish BBC, this would have been the because we were, you know, we're European representing Europe, so it would have been the guys for London that get sent over, and we didn't get shown in a good light. And I think there was a lot of obvious reputational damage that took a long time to recover from. It would have hurt Bob Kelly tremendously, because he was such a Puritan, and he was such a sort of a guy of deep morals, that he would have been horrified to see Celtic players behave like that, even despite the severe provocation. But the thing about Racing Club was, it was very much a step into the unknown. Again, I'm always trying to point out to younger guy people who might be listening to this, we didn't have the technology that my son shows me stuff online about Brazilian football and Argentinian football and even stuff in Asia and Africa and all this kind of thing. We didn't have that coverage in those days. Playing Racing Club would almost have been like playing a team for another planet, because you didn't know anything about them whatsoever. You didn't know anything about their players, their tactics, their style of play. And I think that the shock of playing a team like that was too much for us in the end.
So, obviously we were knocked out of Europe early, and then we had this debacle. Do any of you guys think this had a sort of a negative impact on the club, on the way we looked at international football, or was it just one of these things that we went on, that was life, it was a one season thing, and we moved on from it?
I think the fact that Bob Kelly fined our players was not good for morale, because anybody who'd been there, anybody who'd experienced it, would have realised how badly provoked they were, and how these guys who had up until then a fairly impeccable discipline record had cracked under pressure, and yet he punished our players. And I thought that was just a knee-jerk reaction from, as you see, almost like a Puritan. They didn't deserve that, to come back and be fined by their own club. And I think
it was a lot of money as well. I mean, I remember reading about it. I think it was Tommy Gemmell had it in his book. It was something like £100. 250. Ah, there you go then. It was an exceptional amount of money for 1967.
Yeah.
I mean, they all got paid £2,000 for winning the European Cup in Lisbon.
Mm.
And 6 months later, they all got fined £250 for 90 minutes against the racing club in Uruguay. It was a lot of money.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I mean, it's one of the things I would are genuine to do. In fact, I'm going to try and dig it up and stick it on the site. I think, Robert, you touched on it. The sending off of John Hughes is probably one of the most... It's up there with Tommy Gemmell sending off against East Germany for Scotland. When he just runs
West Germany.
For Scotland, where he just runs and chases a guy about the park and kicks him. John Hughes runs up to the goalkeeper, and I think from memory, he sort of almost like goes to punch the ball out of the keeper's hand. The keeper then does a theatrical lie down on the ground, so he just runs over and kicks him when he's on the ground. I mean, there's no pretense about it. He just runs and kicks a guy.
What Stephen was saying there about the technology and how we can work. Players now are aware that there are cameras everywhere on the ground. And I think Tommy Gemmell thought he was invisible. When he kicked that guy in private, it sneaked around as if no one could see me doing this. But
I mean, to give some context to that £250 fine, I was just quickly Googling it there. The average wage in the UK in 1967 was £923.
Aye.
Which is, in today's money, £15,500. The average car cost £960, which in today's money, £16,000. And the average house cost £3,000, which in today's money, £60,000. But the average wage in the UK was £923 that year. And Bob Kelly fined the players £250. And the players were not like modern footballers. They were earning a wee bit more than the average person, but not dramatically more.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been a big fine. So so by the end of November, we were out of the European Cup and we'd lost the Intercontinental Cup. But we'd secured the League Cup. We still had the Scottish Cup to come and we had the league campaign. So by that point... In the league, we were on doing not too bad. By November, we had remembering that the league starts in September. We'd beaten Clyde, we'd lost to Rangers at Ibrox, drawn with St Johnson, then beaten Stirling Albion, Hibs, Thistle, Motherwell, Airdrie, and we were just about to go on and beat Kilmarnock, Falkirk, and Raith Rovers. So. Things going along okay at that point, George?
They went okay up until New Year. Sir Anthony can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the Clyde, when they beat Clyde 3-2 at Sheffield, was that the day that Ronnie Simpson got carried off?
No, that was 69.
Was it?
The Scottish Cup game.
Aye, that was 69.
Because I remember that, you know, Fallon played in goal in the Old Firm game. In January 2nd.
I can tell you the story about that because obviously I've spoke to John Fallon. He is very aggrieved to this day that he gets a bad rep for that game. Now, basically what happened was Jock Stein had named the team at 2:15 and everybody was happy. So he says he made his way up the stairs to get something to eat. And then he got called into the dressing room at 3:20, whereby Ronnie Simpson was in the toilet with diarrhoea, quite severe, and clearly could not play the game. Now, John Fallon says, it's 23, I've not had any preparation. He says, I basically get stripped, threw my stuff on, ran out in the park without even a warm-up. Now, he does admit that two of the goals he lost that day were soft. He says, but you need to take into account the preparation, because there wasn't any, and it's a specialist position. You can't really hide when you're the goalkeeper. You can't really... break your way into the game, and he said so that there is reasons for the well mitigating circumstances for the poor game he had that day and the two goals that he lost.
Methinks he does protest too much. I was at the game and they were shockers. Really?
He doesn't deny that. All he's trying to point out to people is that it wasn't a normal build up for him and he didn't get any prep. He basically just got thrown in at the last minute.
Well, I know he has become a sort of legend among many of the supporters. He hangs about, you know, you see him a lot at functions and things like that, and he's got a lot to say. But he never managed to keep Frank Haffey out of the team till Frank Haffey got injured. And then when Steen came in, he played him in the first season, but once he saw what he saw, he brought Simpson, whom Steen did not have a great relationship at Hibs with. He brought Simpson back into the team. And it was only through injury that he got back in the team. But before any length of time was by, Steen was away looking for another goalkeeper. He is not as good as he thinks he was. He was a serial offender when it came to having poor games.
To be fair to him, George, he played a lot of games. When you look career-wise, he played a couple of hundred games for Celtic. So, I accept what you're saying, that he was never the recognised number one. But he did have his moments as well, though. There was games that he won for us.
He played some terrific games, but he was not entirely reliable. And the one thing you want for a goalkeeper is reliability. And Steen didn't see that in John Farrell.
So, Robert and Lackey, you're going to have a memory of this that I don't. And I'm looking at the dates of fixtures here. And I'm wanting to verify that Wikipedia has not got this wrong and the Celtic Wiki. So I doubt both of them have got this wrong. 30th of December, Celtic played at home to Dunfermline 3-2.
Yes.
1st of January, 2 days later, Celtic went to Sheffield. Obviously still within Glasgow, but went to Sheffield and won 3-2. 2nd of January, Celtic played at home to Rangers. So is that correct? That Celtic played 30th, 2 days later the 1st, next day the 2nd?
Yeah.
Indeed.
So what
as did Rangers.
Yeah, so Robert, what was going on there? I mean, we played on the 23rd, we didn't play for another week until the 30th, then we played 2 days later, then we played the next day, then we didn't play for another 3 weeks. What was going on?
I have no idea, to be quite honest. I mean, it's something unusual by today's standards, but
the reason for the 3 week delay probably would be down to postponements, because there wasn't any undersoil heating in those days. So a heavy frost, for example, would see a game get postponed. And if you get a period of bad winter weather whereby you're getting snow and ice and frost, then it wasn't unusual in those days to get a 2-3, even a month period without a game.
Yes, true.
So, Lackey, you'd been on the buses. You're now at university. Give us an insight into how people got around and got to games back then, because we've got 30th of December, 1st of January, 2nd of January. Everybody be in the modern world. Well, first of all, you wouldn't have players playing that way, and that's why people got such bad injuries back then, because they're putting too much strain in their bodies, and that's why you might have had freak results as well. But also, you would have had people squealing about how they were supposed to attend those three games when public transport would have been at a minimum. So give us an insight into, you know, very few people had cars. How were people getting around to these games?
Well, certainly January 1st and January 2nd, the public transport in Glasgow was almost non-existent. They had a holiday schedule which was very, very light. I mean, supporters' buses would still be available. People would rent higher supporters' buses. But another feature of the games in those days, I don't know if it's still a feature, was football specials, especially to away games. You know, the BR would run the football specials. I often went to games on the train, to away games. But as you say, they weren't the cars. As far as getting to Glasgow, you could walk around Glasgow if you lived in Glasgow. But there was still obviously a lot of people travelling in the supporters' buses.
So,
I think, Harry, just looking at it, I think the reason why there was three games in 4 days is because the 30th of December was a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And the 1st and 2nd of January were public holidays.
Did we?
Where traditionally fixtures were played. So Clyde on the 1st of January is a game that I remember going to many, many times over the seasons, and it tended to be followed, not always within 24 hours, but sometimes very quickly by, you know, the Rangers game.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? Did you ever see a good game at Shawfield? I have no memories of good games at Shawfield. It was the most uninspiring place.
Yes, probably would agree with that, I think.
The only one I can remember, really, was one night I lived in London Road, which wasn't far from Shawfield, and my friend arrived at my house one night and said, "The Huns are getting beat." I said, "How do you know?" He said, "They're coming out of Shawfield in droves." We jumped in his car, shut down, and they were all complaining, moaning and greeting because the Rangers were getting beat and Celtic were obviously going to go further ahead in whatever title it was that year. But that was only a really amusing experience I've had at Shawfield.
So to give some context to the league season that season, the Scottish League consisted of Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Dunfermline, Aberdeen, Morton, Kilmarnock, Clyde, Dundee, Partick Thistle, Dundee United, Hearts, Airdrie, St Johnstone, Falkirk, Raith Rovers, Motherwell and Stirling Albion. So that was the top flight of Scottish football that season. So we'd had our hiccups in Europe. Our league campaign was not bad, although we had lost to Rangers at Ibrox and then obviously drawn with Rangers at Celtic Park. So we then, 27th of January, the start of the Scottish Cup campaign, we are at home. Last season, we'd reviewed that the whole Scottish Cup took place in Glasgow. So we're at home to Dunfermline. We've already got the League Cup in the bag. We'll be hoping for another treble. Robert, what went wrong?
I wasn't at the game. I do remember listening to it on the radio. And we lost 2-0 at home to Dunfermline. Who, as we've discussed on some of these podcasts, were a very, very good team in the mid-late 60s. I think we were short, from memory, we were short two or three players. I'm not sure if Big Billy played that day, but, you know, we had a reasonable enough squad. We should have been able to cover a couple of absences, but we lost 2-0 on the day. Again, I think it worked in our favour, ultimately, because the run-in for the title was just so tight. You know, Rangers had been ahead since the start of the season. And after losing to Dunfermline in the Scottish Cup, we only had one thing to focus on, which was the league. Whereas Rangers were still in the Scottish Cup and the UEFA Cup. So it helped us at the end of the day.
I have a feeling David Katanach played that day.
I think he did.
If I quickly read the Celtic team for that day, it was Simpson, Katanach, Gemmell, Murdoch, McNeil, Brogan, Johnson, Wallace, McBride, Auld and Hughes.
Yeah.
Should have been enough to win.
Yeah, it was a strong team. But I don't think David Katanach played again. I think he was scapegoated after that game. It was hard on a young player.
But we were out of the Scottish Cup, so Lackey, what was the general attitude of the fans to that?
Well, I was away in Manchester, so I wasn't in tune with anybody other than my own family and guys at the college who supported the team. But it was a shock. But I think you were right, in as much as it was beneficial in the longer term, because they had fewer games to play than our rivals.
So, Robert,
there was a very interesting story about the Glasgow Cup that year.
Yep.
Which, if you like, I can recall.
Yep.
Celtic and Rangers were drawn to play against each other in the semi-final of the Glasgow Cup in February. And as we've discussed before on these podcasts, the Glasgow Cup was contested very keenly in those days. So we were out of Europe, we were out of the Scottish Cup. Rangers were due to meet Leeds in the quarterfinals of the Fair Cities Cup. They were also due to play Hearts in a Scottish Cup quarterfinal match, which ended up going to a replay as well. So they had fixture congestion, and they made quite an amazing decision to concede the game to us. So the semi-final, which would have been played at Ibrox, was awarded to us, and therefore we had a bye into the final to play Clyde. I think Rangers got hammered by the press for that decision.
There was a thing about FTP. You know how they write FTP? It was fear to play.
You mean? Surely they would have avoided the competition, because
that was Fernie Tully and Peacock.
That's the modern way. If a team can't, if you can't complete your fixtures, you just void. Isn't that what they want these days? Just void the competition. Surely they should have been asking for the competition to be void.
It did cause a lot of embarrassment, though, Harry, because I've read right below. I know it's a bit strange, but I've read a couple of Rangers histories for the period. And the Rangers fans for those days were totally mortified at the actions of the Rangers board, because it was basically seen as total, as somebody touched on there, they were total fearties. They were fearty players. And Celtic took a big leap of confidence for what I can hear. I'm sure I remember reading at the time that the jungle was singing the Huns are fearty players, and so say all of us. So the Rangers board be doing that, it received tremendous criticism. Now, bearing in mind that 12 months previously, Celtic had fought on all fronts, Glasgow Cup, Scottish Cup, Europe, the league, and won them all. And for Rangers to come out with the excuse that we've got fixture congestion, it just didn't wash with people, because the truth was that they were frightened to play Celtic, who'd come onto a bit of form and were playing really well. And the idea of playing Celtic and maybe getting a heavy defeat would have knocked them off their stride. So they basically just opted out of playing the Glasgow Cup game, which caused a lot of embarrassment to them.
And it's worth mentioning also, I mean, that Rangers had changed their manager at the beginning of November, because Scott Simon, who had been there for a long, long time and had had quite a lot of success as a Rangers manager, was kind of eased aside, I think, and they took on Davy White, who had some success with Clyde the previous season, but he was only 34 years old. And I think this was an opportunity for Steen to play mind games and, unsettle Davy White's Rangers. And certainly in the lead-up around this period, you know, we had won 6-0 away to Killy. We'd won 6-1 at Perth. We'd won 5-0 at Tannadice, which was an amazing score. And you know, we were putting a lot of pressure on Rangers. I mean, Rangers still led the league, but we were racking up the goals, and, you know, we just needed Rangers to slip up, and, you know, then our superior goal difference and goal average would have taken over. And indeed, that's what happened in April.
If you look at the results from the game at Celtic Park, where they drew 2-2, Celtic won every league match from then on in.
16 straight wins.
Katanak scored against Dundee United, so he didn't get totally cast aside. He must have still been scored.
The other thing that's worth pointing out here is that there's I made a point in the last podcast that there's always a gradual evolution to the team, how things change. Not always, obviously. But over a gradual period, and what's happened at this point is Jim Brogan has taken John Clark's place. I have thought in that over the years that why Jock Steen may have preferred Jim Brogan to John Clark at this period, and John get edged out at that point. And I'm interested to hear what George said there about the Dynamo Kiev game, where John Clark was a wee bit exposed, and I wonder if Jock had maybe had that in mind, which is why he brought Brogan in. But the other thing as well that we really, and the other two guys will be able to comment on this better than me, Bertie Auld get injured around about January, and Charlie Gallagher come in for the running, And everybody of that era who remembers that period always states that Charlie Gallagher was exceptional until the end of the season. It was his best ever period of playing for Celtic, and certainly we wouldn't have won the title without him.
Charlie Gallagher was a brilliant footballer, really was. If you look at the fixtures from New Year on, I think Lennox scores something like 22 goals.
That's right.
He just scores for fun in that period.
And Willie Wallace scored 13 league goals just in March.
Uh-huh. That's right.
He got two hat tricks and a four.
Fours and threes they were scoring. That's right. They just began to run riot, so they did. Yeah. I remember reading a thing. I wrote an article about it for the site years ago. It was about Harry Hood, but it was mentioned Charlie Gallagher in it, that Bob Crabtree said he'd been at a function in Dunfermline. You know how he had a great, Steen had great links with Dunfermline. So he was back there for something. And in the question and answer session, he'd made some comment about you wouldn't win too many leagues with Charlie Gallagher and Harry Hood in your team. Bob Crabtree said to him, but you have to have at least one of them. And he said, I will give you that. You have to have at least one of them. You have to have that type of player in your team. So I think sometimes, although we had a great reputation for football, I'm not sure that Big Jock, a wee bit like Martin, entirely trusted genius.
Yes. No, I think he preferred Auld, who had a bit more dig around his game. Mm-hmm. But the night I remember vividly about the league run-in was, I had to check the date, but it was the 17th of April, so Rangers had three games left, we had two games left.
Yeah.
And I was at Hampden that night with my dad in for the Glasgow Cup final against Clyde. And we were 7-0 up at half time, and Clyde clearly not so good after Davy White had left them. But Rangers were at Capello that night, and for the whole of the second half, all I remember was people with their transistor radios. Rangers were still a point ahead, and if they had won at Morton, won at Killy, and then beaten Aberdeen at home, the league was theirs, irrespective of what we did. But they were 3-1 down at Capello at one stage, and the atmosphere at Hampden in the Glasgow Cup final was amazing. Not because of what was going on in the Glasgow Cup final, which eventually ended up 8-0, but you know, Rangers scrambled a draw and they got a 3-3. Yeah. But what that did was put us ahead on goal difference.
John Gregg dragged them to a draw that night. I remember getting home from the game, the Glasgow Cup game, and Rangers and Morton were in the telly. And he literally dragged them to a draw. I mean, I know we think he was a bit of a hammer thrower, but he could play, John Gregg. And had he not been there to get beat that night, it was really a terrific performance.
But,
that was the night Berfield sat in the ball.
Against Clyde?
Aye. And Steen was furious with him. He said, you don't disrespect your fellow professionals.
Yes.
Remember
that? He did it again against Clyde on his last ever game.
Did he? I don't remember that. I remember
the 71 game when the last appearance of the Lizard Line, last game of the season against Clyde.
Going back to the Morton 3-8 game there, my dad was in the game that night, but for some reason he didn't know the score, and he said it was on STV, and Arthur Montford said, we've got a big treat for you tonight, we've got a 6-goal thrower for Capello. And my dad thought, all right, I'm 5-1 or 4-2 for Rangers. And he said he was watching the highlights, and when Morton got a third goal he went mental, because he knew at that point that Rangers had at least a point, if not lose the game. He said, and he was ecstatic.
Was Arthur Montford not a Morton fan?
He was.
That's right. That's why I said it was a treat for us.
So where we were after that Morton 3-3 draw with Rangers was both teams were on 59 points with two games left. Celtic superior goal difference or goal average was actually still in play at the time. But, you know, we had Morton at home on the Saturday, then Dunfermline away, which was a tough game. Rangers had Kelly away and Aberdeen at home. So there was little margin for error. And I was at the Morton game on the Saturday following the 3-3.
Yeah.
And we, I think we'd applauded or, you know, cheered Morton onto the field because of the job they'd done against Rangers on the Wednesday night. But we weren't cheering, you know, with 90 minutes on the clock because it was one each at Parkhead. Yeah. And Rangers had won late at Kilmarnock. And the Rangers fans had invaded the pitch at Rugby Park because there had been an announcement that Celtic had drawn one each against Morton, and that would have put Rangers a point ahead in the league. But we hadn't dropped a point because Bobby Lineup scored the winner, I think, with about 20 seconds left.
That's right.
And that certainly cleared the pitch at Rugby Park, if not emptied the entire stadium. So that put us, we were still ahead on goal average. And Rangers, who hadn't lost a league game all season, played their last game at home to Aberdeen, which was on Cup Final Day. And again, Rangers got a lot of bad PR for putting on a game in Glasgow on the same day as Dunfermline played Hearts in the Scottish Cup Final. And it, you know, it probably affected the crowd and at Hampden. And Jockstein took the whole Celtic first team squad to Hampden, probably again with a Dunfermline angle in mind. And so Rangers, having been unbeaten for 33 league games, lost at home to Aberdeen on the last, a very late goal. I think it was Harry Johnson scored the goal, and that was basically the league one. So we went to Dunfermline on the Wednesday night, and we had to lose 16-0.
There's a wonderful photograph of that Morton game when Bobby Lennox scores that late goal. And it's a Morton player, I think, but we all must have seen it in books through the years. It's a Morton player, and he's actually hanging on the goal net. He's tried desperately to clear the ball, and his momentum's carried him into the net. And he's actually swinging in the net in frustration as the Celtic players turn away. And as a wee boy, that always was a great image to me, you know, the drama. It just summed up the drama of the moment, and the whole league season, the 34 games, basically hung it in the space of about 10 seconds of that ball going into the net. Another thing as well, as Robert says, Rangers hadn't lost a game all season, so the last one to Aberdeen. There's a Rangers fan of my acquaintance that I used to work with, and he said, I think we'll remember a guy called Jimmy Smith, who was a terrific player for Newcastle in his day. And he started at Aberdeen, and that guy told me, he says that Jimmy Smith had a game of his life that day. He was absolutely tremendous.
He was a brilliant
Jimmy Smith came to Celtic briefly.
He had injury problems, so he came to us.
Nah, that was a shame.
A great, great footballer.
Yeah, one of the guys I used to work with was a Newcastle United fan, and he said Jimmy Smith was one of the best players he's ever seen put on a Newcastle strip.
Brilliant footballer.
He done Celtic a good turn that day, by all accounts.
Yeah.
And see the Morton game. You know how, for all the years we've followed them, there have been certain games where the elation was so strong, you never forget it. You know, he was winner against Dunfermline in the winning European Cup final. That day, when Lennox scored, was one of those days for me. Behind the goal, it was just such a relief when they scored. It was a brilliant game.
I would have thought that, you know, if you looked at all nine league championships that we won, I think this was the hardest one to win, because we were chasing all season. Yeah. We'd had these bad moments, you know, against Kiev and against Racing Club. We had to show a lot of resilience to get back on track, but our form in the second half of the season, 16 straight wins after the Old Firm game, scoring tons of goals. I think it's my favourite out of the nine.
Yeah, yeah. And to be fair, I was surprised when we were looking at the 66 game, the 65-66. My memory of that season was of brilliant, brilliant wins. And yet, they struggled over the line on the last day against Motherwell, effectively. It was a very close finish. mean, Lisbon, they went to Ibrox and drew, which kind of guaranteed them the title. And then this season, it's the last game of the season. They weren't running away with it, which shows you the strength of Scottish football.
Mm-hmm. Well, I say that's one of the remarkable things. If you look at it, we won the first game of the season, lost the second game of the season, drew the third game of the season. So we drop 3 points out of four, or in two of the first three games of the season. Then we draw two more games all season, yet it still goes down to the final game of the season. I mean, again, it's partly down to the fewer games that are played as well. You know, four fewer games than we play in the current season. So, it's quite remarkable. And it also demonstrates how Rangers blew it, actually, if you think about it.
Absolutely blew it.
I suppose the argument would be all that happened was we had a silly start to the season and they had a silly end to the season. You know, they dropped four out of 6 points. Three out of 6 points in the last three games. We dropped three out of 6 points in the first three games.
Yeah, but I think if they had beaten Aberdeen in the last game,
they'd have won it.
They could have won it because we would have been going to Dunfermline on the Wednesday, you know, under huge pressure. Mm. It was the biggest crowd ever in the history of East End Park. The game got stopped two or three times, as I remember, because of crowds just spilling on to the pitch. It was a pretty dangerous situation. I think there was a bit of a police inquiry afterwards about the number of people who were inside the ground. And obviously we were able to play that game in a pressure-free environment because of the superior goal difference. But yeah, Rangers, I think that was their biggest challenge over the nine seasons, and the one that they could very easily have won. But on the other hand, Blackie says, you know, they stole a point at Parkhead on the 2nd of January, a game we should have won. But, you know, Celtic, given that we only took 1 point out of four in the two Rangers games, we took 62 points out of 64 against the rest of the league. Mm-hmm. And that is astonishing consistency. And even the Kiev moments and the Racing Club moments didn't cause us to, you know, derail in the league games in the first part of the season.
So going back to the East End Park game there, I always remember my dad saying that it was the most scared he'd ever been at a football game. He'd been at Hampden when there was 120,000, 130,000 in it, and never really thought nothing of it. But he was outside the ground that night, and the turnstiles had shut. And they reckon that there was an estimated 20,000 people outside who couldn't get in. And my dad said, what actually happened is the weight of people against one of the exits actually smashed on a door. And he said, if anybody had been on the other side of that door, you know, they would have died for the weight of the people. And he said, there was a big surge forward. People fell. People got crushed. He said, it's an absolute miracle that nobody died that night. There was people up in the roofs. They had to stop the game. There was people on the stand roof. There was people up in the floodlights. For health and safety point of view, it was an absolute nightmare. And he said it was like a party atmosphere, though, because obviously Celtic had to avoid getting beat 10-0 or whatever it was. Just the commotion outside and the getting into the stadium. He never paid in, obviously, because the barrier sort of the door went down and everybody just charged in for free. So the 28,000 crowd, they reckon it could have been anything up to 35,000 that night, with another 20,000 locked out. It was incredible.
Well, I'm just reading on the Celtic Wiki that the estimates were that there was more than 30,000 in the ground, and that the police estimated that 25,000 Celtic fans were locked out, which is remarkable that there was 55,000 there. Because that was on the Wednesday night, on the Saturday, and we just talked about the challenges of getting across the country at that time of year. On the Saturday, there was only 35,000 Rangers fans watching them against Aberdeen, which, as we've pointed out, could have been the game that they won the league. I've got a brilliant quote, actually, that I'm just reading about Rangers losing to Aberdeen. After the game, Rangers striker Alex Ferguson, the club's leading scorer that season with 23 goals, was approached by a frustrated fan who toe-punted him viciously in the shin before wandering off. "I couldn't really blame him," said Ferguson. "I felt as sick as he did."
See, you're saying there, Brian, about, you know, the games they lost. After they lost to Rangers in September 16th, they only dropped 3 points the rest of the season. That's some doing.
But the amazing thing is that of the points that Celtic dropped that season, they lost to Rangers and drew with Rangers. So three of the points they dropped were against Rangers. The Celtic team against Dunfermline was Simpson, Craig, Gemmell, Murdoch, McNeil, Brogan, getting back to your point saying about Brogan being in the team, Johnson, Lennox, Wallace, Gallagher, who was subbed for Connolly, and Hughes. Interestingly,
that was George Connolly's first game.
Well,
that was his debut.
Interestingly as well, I always think it's interesting to look at the Celtic reserves at that time as well, to see some players who were kicking around the club. And also the difference between reserve team football then and what the equivalent of reserve team football would be now. Because the Celtic team was Wraith, Katanak, Gorman, who ended up having John Gorman having a decent career and as a management level as well. McGrain, Young, O'Neill, Clark, Chalmers, McBride, Hay and McCarry. Celtic drew 1-1 with Dunfermline reserves that night. Lou McCarry was the scorer. There's two of the Lisbon Lions playing reserve football in Clark and Chalmers. The other
seriously, Clark and Chalmers shortly shipped out to Morton.
Well, it was 1971.
Was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It lasted another 2 years now.
The other remarkable thing, you mentioned, Robert, about the criticism of Rangers for playing on the same day as the Scottish Cup final, which we touched on the last podcast. But the other remarkable thing is that it was allowed a situation where two teams going for the title were allowed to play their final game. Celtic had the advantage of knowing what they needed to do on the last game of the season by playing on the Wednesday.
It could have been a disadvantage as well.
Well, it could have been with the pressure on, but...
But in those days, I mean, the Scottish Cup was run by the SFA, the league was run by the Scottish League, so two different organisations, and I think it was quite common that other things were going on Cup final day. But again, the Rangers, the media were very critical of Rangers for not rearranging their game against Aberdeen.
I saw someone on Twitter the other day saying that he'd been to the Celtic Dunfermline Cup final and then gone home to watch Kilmarnock playing Hearts in the league decider on the television that night.
That's true.
Part of his family had gone to see the Celtic and part of them had gone to see Kilmarnock.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't uncommon for a crucial league game to be played in the same day as the Scottish Cup final.
There's an interesting wee story coming out of this season as well that's worth mentioning. Bobby Leonard scored a tremendous amount of goals in the running. I think the guys were touching on there, it was something like 20 goals in the last 12 games or something like that. Now, he scored 32 in total. It was his best ever season for scoring. And he finished third in the European top scorers list. And from memory, I think Eusebio was a winner, and Benny, who was the guy for Upestoza, who was a terrific player at the time, he finished second. Now, a few months later, there was a big presentation in the UEFA headquarters in Switzerland, and Eusebio was there, and the Hungarian guy was there, and Jimmy Farrell went on behalf of Celtic to collect Bobby Lennox's trophy. And Lennox had no idea that he was due that trophy and no idea that Jimmy Farrell had travelled. The nice wee joint that one, so, you know, a wee trip to Switzerland, probably a big lunch that went with, or a big dinner. and free drink, and you can imagine that the hospitality, you know, nothing would be too much trouble. And Bobby Lennox was very aggrieved after that for many, many years, because neither Jock Stein or the club had the decency to tell him that, A, he was due the trophy. He didn't have an idea that he was just happy with the number of goals scored. The A, he was getting a trophy, which was presented to him when Farrell came back, and B, there was this big dinner that he would have been obviously invited to, and didn't he get in order it. So it's an indication of how the club was running those days that kind of thing could happen.
So we have tied up another title, and the world in the next 2 years is about to be transformed from a black and white world to a colour world. We're about to stick a man on the moon, and then we're about to move to virtual shutdown and lockdown with 3 day weeks. So there's a transformational period coming up, but at the end of the Beatles and all the swinging 60s stuff will come to an end shortly as well. So do you have any specific memories of the 67-68 season, Robert, first of all, that stick in your mind?
Well, I've talked about a number of them, certainly games that I was at and games that I remember. The other award we picked up during the season was in December, and it was, a hangover from the Lisbon season, was that we won the team award in the BBC Sports Personality of the Year programme, which, you know, used to be compulsive viewing in our house, but, you know, I haven't seen it for many, many years. And I remember the whole Celtic team and Big Jock down there in the television studios in London being presented with the trophy by Matt Busby. And I remember clearly Big Jock in giving thanks to Busby. He wished his great friend and Manchester United all the best for the remainder of that season's European Cup. And of course they went on to win it against Benfica at Wembley. And for anybody who's interested in any completely useless trivia in what must have been a very, very slow year for English sport, Henry Cooper won the BBC Sports Personality of the Year that year ahead of Beryl Burton and Harvey Smith. So heady days indeed.
I remember Harvey Smith being a celebrity at the time, basically because of the concept he was a working class guy in a posh sport. That seemed to be the general gist of why he seemed to be. That's my earliest memories of any sort of class culture in the UK, that Harvey Smith was loved for being a working class guy in an upper class sport.
I remember
he also became infamous for that famous V sign.
Yep.
I remember being very. I felt sorry for Manchester City because they won the league title. I'd been to some of their games and I'd been to some of Manchester United's games during the season. But they won the league title for the first time in donkey's years, and Manchester United eclipsed them by winning the European Cup. I felt sorry for Man City, their fans, because they were a great team, but they were just... They were like a sideshow because of Manchester United's win.
Forever in the shadow of Man United.
Exactly.
Well, with that, I will say, Lackey, Robert, St. Anthony, thanks very much. And I look forward to discussing season 68-69.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Take care.
Thanks, Harry.
I see trees of green. Red roses too.
I had to let Engelbert Humperdinck play a bit longer at the beginning because it just reminds me so much of mom and dad, particularly my dad for some reason. Anyway, enough of me. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Obviously, we'll have season 4 coming up, 68-69, and all the events that took place then. I was on a Zoom call today. I wish I'd bought shares on Zoom. I'd be making a fortune. Call earlier today with the guys from the Celtic FC Foundation, and the job they are doing is absolutely breathtaking in these challenging times, and what they are doing for NHS workers. Many of us, many people listening, will be struggling just now, but if you didn't, and we've never charged you a penny for 14 seasons of doing this podcast, and we're not going to change. But if you like the podcast we're doing and you're in the fortunate position that money's not a stress at the moment, if you can find, go onto the Celtic FC Foundation website and find a way of donating whatever you can afford, it'd be greatly appreciated and it'll go a long, long way at this time. Anyway, enough of me. Please take care, look after yourself. Good night and God bless.
I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.